How would you like to receive a CD of one of my Easter and Ascension sermons? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin, and for any size gift during the Lenten season, we'll send you a CD with two sermons. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check, Lutheran Public Radio, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. And for any size gift, before Easter Sunday, we'll send you a CD of one of my Easter and Ascension sermons.
It could be that at some earlier time, somewhere in the universe, a civilization evolved by probably some kind of Darwinian means to a very, very high level of technology and designed a form of life that they seeded onto perhaps this planet. Now, that is a possibility and intriguing.
Wait a second. Richard Dawkins thought intelligent design might be a legitimate pursuit?
And that designer could well be a higher intelligence from elsewhere in the universe. Well, but that higher intelligence would itself have had to have come about by some explicable or ultimately explicable process.
So Professor Dawkins was not against intelligent design, just certain types of designers, such as God.
A little snippet from the documentary Expelled by Ben Stein, a conversation with Richard Dawkins, famous New Atheist. Now, one of the boilerplate assumptions of the New Atheism and of much of our culture today when it comes to science and Christianity is that the two have been locked in mortal combat ever since science first reared its head and began to give us enlightenment and knowledge and a way of understanding the world without God. Somehow, the myth has grown up that Christianity and science are not only in conflict, but they are in complete contradiction with one another. Is that true? Joining us to talk about the Christian Middle Ages and the scientific revolution, Dr. James Hannum. He's a graduate of Oxford and Cambridge, where he studied physics, and he holds a PhD in the history of science. He's authored a new book, The Genesis of Science. Dr. Hannum, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you very much indeed. It's great to be there.
Dr. Hannum, what is the biggest myth about the origins of the scientific modern science and Middle Ages Christianity?
Well, the biggest myth is that Christianity held back the rise of science. Lots and lots of people imagine that Christianity has been an impediment to scientific progress, and that simply isn't true. And in fact, historians of science have known that this simply isn't true for some time now, but somehow truth hasn't yet percolated into the general population, and many people still believe that there is a great conflict between science and religion, that historically that's inaccurate. And also, about the Middle Ages in particular, people imagine that there probably was no scientific progress in the Middle Ages. But that's not true either. There was a great deal of important scientific work which fed through directly into the work of people like Copernicus and Galileo during the scientific revolution.
Well, just last night, Dr. Hannum, I was filling out a historical timeline with my high school-aged son, and they were dealing with the Middle Ages. And there was this space in the timeline labeled the Dark Ages that was pretty much absent of anything except some really bad stuff. There was no notable advancement during that. And the typical story told in the textbook was that during this part of the Middle Ages, not only nothing happened, but the world was a very backward and awful place. Now, in a certain sense, that's true, but were there already during that time the beginnings of real science being done with Christian thinkers?
Well, I think there was. It's certainly true that after the fall of the Roman Empire in the 5th century AD, Europe went through a very bad time. But they did quite quickly start trying to pick themselves up. And during that period, you see advances in agriculture, the population increasing. And then in the 8th and 9th centuries, Christian scholars began to start looking again at science and try to master the astronomy, for instance, which they found in the old Roman manuscripts. And that made them realize that they were missing a lot. And as a result of that, they went out and they started trying to find the Greek science that they knew existed from the manuscripts that they had, to try and bring themselves back up to the state of scientific knowledge that people had enjoyed during the ancient world. And as soon as they'd got to that stage, they started pushing forward beyond where the ancient world had got to.
So in a sense, there was a revival of far more ancient, we might say pre-Christian science, that Christians pushed forward.
Well, that's true. And they had to push it forward because, in fact, although the achievements of the ancient Greeks in science, and particularly in math, were very great, Greek science had come to a bit of a dead end long before the fall of the Roman Empire. And it was only when that science, I think, was combined with Christian theology about where the world came from, how God had created it, how God was a reliable person, so that the laws of nature were something that could be relied on. That science really took off in the Middle Ages.
Well, let's take a break here, and when we come back, could the Christian worldview of a creator God who creates into his creation order and law be divorced from the first inklings of scientific inquiry? I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. James Hannum is our guest, author of The Genesis of Science. We're talking about the Christian Middle Ages and the scientific revolution.
When you need a friend, you have a friend in Jesus Christ, the Good Shepherd, and friends among his people at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, Arnold, Missouri. At Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, we offer Christ-centered word and sacrament ministry, inspirational liturgical worship services, and faithful preaching and teaching. Sunday worship services are at 9 a.m. Sunday school and Bible class are at 10:30. We also have an excellent Christian preschool. We invite you to join us. Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, 2211 Tenbrook Road, Arnold, Missouri, 636-296-1292.
How would you like to receive a CD of one of my Easter and Ascension sermons? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin, and for any size gift during the Lenten season, we'll send you a CD with two sermons. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. You can also donate by check, Lutheran Public Radio, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. And for any size gift, before Easter Sunday, we'll send you a CD of one of my Easter and Ascension sermons.
Smartest listeners in radio, you're listening to Issues Etc.
The most pro-abortion president ever.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
President Barack Obama's statement on the 38th anniversary of Roe v. Wade confirms he is radically pro-abortion. Thanks to Roe, 53 million unborn children and dozens of women have died at the hands of abortionists. Thousands have been emotionally or physically wounded. Yet in his statement, Obama didn't mention the unborn child or even hint that there is anything tragic about abortion. Whereas his Democratic predecessor expressed a desire for abortion to be rare, President Obama, in contrast, praised abortion as a fundamental right and pledged to do everything he could to protect and promote it.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. It's Monday, March the 21st. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the scientific revolution and the Christian Middle Ages. Not all the history that we have assumed or learned is necessarily true. It went forward not so much in spite of or against Christian thought, but with and because of Christian thought. Dr. James Hannum is our guest. He's a graduate of Oxford and Cambridge, where he studied physics, and he holds a PhD in the history of science. His new book, The Genesis of Science. Dr. Hannum, could the Christian worldview of a creator God, you mentioned this before the break, who created into his creation order, ever be divorced from the first inklings of scientific inquiry?
Well, I think the idea that the world is created by a God who has ensured that it does obey the laws of nature that he's laid down is absolutely essential to science, because unless you believe that the laws of nature are fixed and are orderly, then you have no reason at all to do science in the first place. And although people in the ancient world did realize that the world works according to natural rules, they mistakenly thought that they could work these out simply by sitting down and thinking very hard about them. Whereas Christians realize that actually God does not have to create the world in the way that we think he ought to. So the only way that you can tell how God actually made the world is by going out and looking, doing experiments, that sort of thing. So we were able, as Christian scholars, were able to push science much further than the ancient Greeks had been able to do. And by the time of the 14th and 15th centuries, we see real scientific progress well past what the ancient Greeks had managed.
How would you retell the story or correct the story of the church's reaction to the Copernican Revolution?
Well, initially, the church did not have much of a reaction because they didn't really care. Everybody thought that Copernicus was very clever, very interesting, and wrong. And he was saying, of course, that the Earth goes around the Sun rather than the other way around. And people said, well, that's silly. The Earth obviously isn't moving. We could feel it if it was. And Copernicus's arguments about our not being able to feel that the Earth moves had actually been developed during the Middle Ages, and he just takes them and doesn't acknowledge where he got them from. And a bit later on, when people thought, well, hang on, maybe Copernicus might be right, then the church began to get a bit concerned because they were worried that it suggested that they would have to interpret the Bible in a figurative way. Now, this wasn't really that much of a problem because people did accept that parts of the Bible were metaphorical, and it speaks about God having hands and feet, for instance, which obviously he doesn't really have. But it did require, as far as the church was concerned, people to be very cautious and very careful, and above all, that there should be proof that Copernicus was right before they were willing to start interpreting the Bible in a different way. Unfortunately, people weren't willing to wait. They weren't willing to be cautious, and the church stepped in, and in 1616, it banned people from saying Copernicus was right. And that, of course, was a catastrophic mistake by the Catholic Church. I don't think we can get away from that. But I don't think that on its own should overshadow all the good that the Church did in the Middle Ages and subsequently supporting science.
How quickly did the Church realize its mistake in condemning Copernicus and then begin to encourage the advancement of modern science?
Well, I think the church realized its mistake much earlier than the church admitted its mistake. It wasn't until, I think, 1835 that Galileo's works, where he had said Copernicus was right, were all finally unbanned. But I think prior to that time, it was tacitly realized that they had made a mistake. They just didn't want to admit it, which unfortunately is a problem with the Catholic Church. It sometimes worries more about its own reputation than what it should actually be doing.
I was recently watching a kind of a popular biography of Sir Isaac Newton, and it was he was portrayed in a very interesting way, a man kind of half mad by his intellect, but also by the practice of alchemy. And I had never heard this before, that he was not only a brilliant mathematician, but also believed in alchemy, which is, we think today, kind of akin to magic. What's the story there?
Well, Sir Isaac Newton was a very interesting person. One of my professors at Cambridge describes him as the most religious man of the 17th century among some very stiff competition. And he believed all sorts of things that to us don't sound very sensible. He thought doomsday would be in around about 2050 and thought he could calculate that from the Bible. And also, as you say, he believed in alchemy. But in fact, he investigated alchemy in a very methodical, careful, and experimental way, such that perhaps it was the last time anybody ever felt the need to try it really carefully, because he didn't manage to do what he thought he was going to be able to do with alchemy, despite turning the full force of his genius to try and work it out. But it does tell us that just because today we think something is scientific or isn't scientific, we shouldn't automatically assume that the geniuses from past eras are going to see things in the same way that we do.
It is emblematic in a way of how science began in a lot of ways as having to dispel some of the magical thinking or magical worldview that was so common in the Middle Ages. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, I think the dispelling of what we call the magical worldview wasn't really done by science. I think that was largely done by the church. The church, both Catholic and Protestant, had very strong feelings about superstition and about magic. And although it wasn't until well after the Middle Ages that we got the terrible witch trials and that sort of thing, during the Middle Ages, the Catholic Church told intellectuals what the limits were for scientific inquiry. And basically, they said, you can't assume that astrology is correct. You can't practice magic. You have to be careful about alchemy and not claim that you can change things into gold when you can't. So the church, I think, had quite an important role in forcing scientists to concentrate on what we would consider to be real science rather than peripheral magical thinking, which, as you say, continued to have an attraction for a very long time.
Where is the, in terms of the Middle Ages, Dr. Hannum, where is the high point for science and the method?
Well, the high point in the Middle Ages, I think, took place at the universities of Oxford and Paris in the 14th century, just before the Black Death killed an awful lot of very important medieval thinkers. And during that time, the laws of motion and the science of mechanics, which had been developed by the ancient Greeks, was criticized and rewritten. And mathematics was used in a way that hadn't happened before to try and understand the way that things move. Graphs were used to try and prove physical theories, all the things which to nowadays seem to us to be just commonplaces of the way we do science, but hadn't really been done at all before the 14th century were developed then.
How important was William of Ockham in all of that?
William of Ockham is an interesting case because although he's very famous and people tend to imagine him as perhaps being a scientific thinker, perhaps because of Ockham's razor, which is that famous phrase that is often used about science, although he's a very important philosopher, his scientific influence, I don't think, is all that great. I think it's a case. For example, another example would be Roger Bacon, somebody else who people imagine was important in science. And, of course, there's the myth that he was in prison for it, although that's not true. Just because the most famous names of the Middle Ages are the ones that we imagine were looking at science doesn't necessarily mean that when you start looking at what they actually did, you find that they are the most significant ones. So I think William of Ockham's scientific influence isn't all that great. A bit like Leonardo da Vinci, somebody else who people always imagine had a great influence on science, but in fact didn't.
Well, when we come back, if these men were not as great a contributor to the scientific revolution as is usually taught, those are the success stories that are always told to us, who really was? We're talking about the Christian Middle Ages and the scientific revolution. Dr. James Hannum is our guest, a graduate of Oxford and Cambridge, where he studied physics. He holds a PhD in the history of science, and he's authored the new book, The Genesis of Science, How the Christian Middle Ages Launched the Scientific Revolution. When we come back, who was the most influential advancer of science in the Middle Ages with a Christian worldview? We'll see what the answer to that question is. We want to hear your stories, by the way. We're asking for your Issues Etc. story on the Issues Etc. comment line before Thursday, April the 7th. The comment line number 618-223-8384. 618-223-8384. We want your Issues Etc. story on the comment line. 618-223-8384 before Thursday, April the 7th. You'll find study notes highlighting the promises of God and Jesus' death for you in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March, the Faith Alive Student Bible. This full-color Bible for students ages 8 through high school is edited by Issues Etc. regular guest, Dr. Carl Fikencher. You can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org, or you can purchase the Faith Alive Study Bible by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040.
Do you have an Issues Etc. story to tell? We want to hear from you. Tell us your Issues Etc. story by calling our comment line before Thursday, April 7th, 618-223-8384. Be sure to give us your first name and tell us where you're from. Now, the listener with the best story will receive the first three Issues Etc. books of the month for this year. 618-223-8384. 618-223-8384.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Here are two new ways to stay connected to Issues Etc., Facebook and Twitter. You'll find photos of in-studio guests at facebook.com/issuesetc, and you'll find a list of upcoming topics and guests on Twitter at issuesetc. Social networking for the thinking Christian, facebook.com/issuesetc, and on Twitter at issuesetc. Connect with fellow Issues Etc. junkies today, facebook.com/issuesetc, and on Twitter at issuesetc.
Hi, this is Kate in Japan, and I'm commenting on the program you had about the Unification Church.
Thanks to God's gift of the Internet, people are listening to Issues Etc. around the world.
The most important point is to say I love your show and thank you for doing what you do. Bye from Japan.
Old theology, new technology, Issues Etc. worldwide. Listen to what you want, when you want, wherever you are. Issues Etc. issuesetc.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. 10 more minutes on this Monday afternoon, March the 21st, talking the Christian Middle Ages and the Scientific Revolution with Dr. James Hannum, author of the book The Genesis of Science. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll be talking with our regular guest, Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morse of the Ruth Institute, about a website that gives college students the opportunity to hook up, to engage in casual sexual encounters. It's made it simple. You know, you think back to the days of Facebook just helping people connect. Now they're doing more than connecting online. We'll see what Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morse has to say about that tomorrow on Issues Etc. So far in our conversation, we have learned that the scientific revolution took place not in spite of or against the resistance of Christianity in the church, but with the help of, and in many ways aided along by, a Christian worldview. Before the break, Dr. Hannum, you said that men like Occam, Da Vinci get a lot of ink, but they were not necessarily the big contributors to the scientific revolution. If not men like this, who was?
Well, I think the greatest was Jean Buridan, who I would suspect you and many of your listeners would not have heard of. He was a French philosopher who worked in Paris and died around about 1350. And he developed the science of mechanics that we were talking about earlier. He showed that Aristotle was wrong about the way that objects move and objects move when they're dropped. He also developed the idea that if an object has no friction acting on it, then it will keep going forever, something today we call the Newton's first law. But in fact, the ancient Greeks had thought the opposite, that if something wasn't being moved by something else, it would just stop. So although this thinker, Jean Buridan, is almost totally unknown today, I think he is one of the most significant men of science in history.
To which branch of science, so to speak, if we can even talk about it at that stage, to which branch of science was the church most resistant during the Middle Ages?
Most resistant? I think that's quite difficult to say. I think one thing that it didn't like was atomism, the idea that things are made up of atoms rather than being continuous, because it was worried that conflicted with transubstantiation. But generally speaking, apart from what we call pseudosciences of astrology and magic, the church, I think, took a fairly benign view of most branches of science.
It is often said that the Renaissance, in particular the Italian Renaissance, was this great flowering of scientific knowledge and enlightenment. Is that overplayed?
Well, I think it is. I think partly it's overplayed because people imagine nothing very much happened in the Middle Ages, there must necessarily be this great flowering to get to where we are today. But I think it was actually worse than that in the Renaissance, because during that time, people called humanists, who were students of the ancient world and particularly ancient Greek and Latin, began to say that there was nothing worth studying in the Middle Ages, and as a result, vast amounts of medieval learning was just thrown in the bin because it wasn't trendy, because the intellectual fad at the time was that anything that was worth knowing came from the ancient world. And you find, unbelievably, for example, that the University of Oxford managed to lose its entire library during the Renaissance just because people imagined that because it was medieval, there was nothing interesting there. And it was only because printing had been invented in the 1450s, and many of these medieval works had already been printed, that I think some of the scientific discoveries of the Middle Ages were preserved for later generations.
Two final questions, Dr. Hannum. How did scientific advancement fare under the Protestant Reformation?
Well, I don't think that whether somebody was a Catholic or a Protestant made a huge amount of difference to how good they were as scientists. There is certainly a theory that Protestantism was better for science. Puritanism in particular was better for science than the Catholic religion is. But if you look at the evidence, if you look at where the greatest scientists lived and whether they were Catholics or Protestants, you actually find that it's pretty even Stevens. I think if Protestantism did have a positive effect, then it was probably because they were even more against the idea of a sacralized nature than Catholics were.
What one thing in the Christian worldview, in your opinion, most contributed to the birth and, or shall we say, the scientific revolution?
Well, I think the most important thing was this idea that the world is created by God, and although God is the ultimate cause of everything, he sets out certain secondary causes of the laws of nature which determine the way that the world actually runs. But those laws of nature are chosen freely by God. They aren't determined by logical reason necessarily. He has freedom about how he wants the universe to work. So the only way that you can tell exactly what those laws are is to go out and look and to do experiments. And so that theological view of the world, I think, is very, very fertile for scientific thinking.
It is often asserted today, and even believed by many Christians today, that science and Christianity, if only as worldviews, are in direct conflict, in some cases, some would believe, incompatible with one another. What would you say to that, Dr. Hannum?
Well, I don't think that's true at all. I think that science tells us how the material world works, and if you're a Christian, it tells us how God decided the material world should work. But it doesn't tell us how we should behave. It doesn't tell us what's good and what's bad. It certainly doesn't tell us how to get to heaven, which is probably quite an important question for a lot of us. But also, science doesn't say that there's no God. It doesn't say that miracles are impossible. It merely says that we're not really concerned with miracles. So the incompatibility only arises if science is allowed to make claims which are outside its own realm, or if religion makes claims about the natural world which are outside its area of expertise.
Has much of modern science, or perhaps we should say scientism, has it become a religion in itself?
Well, it has become a philosophy which people who believe it claim explains everything. But whether or not that's a religion, I don't know, because when people talk about what their religion is, they're generally not talking about the same sorts of things that the New Atheists are talking about for science. New Atheists, I think, use science to try and push their views on other things, but I've never really felt that their thinking is developed enough to be called a religion.
Dr. James Hannum is graduate of Oxford and Cambridge, where he studied physics. He holds a PhD in the history of science, and he's author of the new book, The Genesis of Science. Dr. Hannum, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you very much for having me.
Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for March is aimed at your kids. In fact, between ages 8 and 18, this is a perfect gift. It is an actual study Bible, unlike so many Bibles that are sold in Christian bookstores that are really Bibles that have been kind of tailor-made or dumbed down for children. This is an actual study Bible written at the level of kids 8 to 18. It's called the Faith Alive Student Study Bible. It's in the English Standard Version. It has notes from none other than Issues, Etc. regular guest, Dr. Carl Fikencher, Christ-centered, cross-focused. Find out more about it at our website, issuesetc.org, or call and order the Faith Alive Student Study Bible from Concordia Publishing House. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Tomorrow on Issues, Etc., we'll talk with Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morse of the Ruth Institute about a website that gives college students the opportunity to engage in casual sexual encounters, to hook up with one another, and it makes it very easy. Just a click of a button at the website, and there you go. One of the statements at the website says, chastity is curable if detected early. We'll see what Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morse thinks about that tomorrow, Tuesday, on Issues, Etc. The Christian mind is truly enlightened. That is not to say that Christians are smarter than unbelievers. It's not a matter of intellect, but they see the world as it really is, and they can see it without any real conflict between reason, science, and faith, as long as reason and science take their proper place as the servant to theology and the servant to faith. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk with you again tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues, Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.